Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You will find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Anna Mock, the chairman of our wonderful Board of Governors, and I want to welcome you all to this special event. Today's program is part of the club's series on ethics and accountability, underwritten by the Charles Travers family. Tonight's moderator is Mary Marcy, president of the Dominican University. Mary is also a member of our Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. I have the privilege of introducing our distinguished guests, the University of California's new president, she's been in her job for a month, Janet Napolitano. President Napolitano, President Napolitano is leading a university system with 10 campuses, 5 medical centers, 3 national laboratories, and a statewide agriculture and natural resources program. The UC system has 500,000 faculty, students, and staff members, and an annual operating budget of more than $24 billion. While most anyone would be daunted by overseeing such an enormous, complex, and diverse system, she brings a vast amount of experience, including leading large, complex organizations to the job. Her bio is quite long, so just to highlight some of the things that she's done, she served as the Secretary of Homeland Security from 2009 to 2013, heading 22 agencies and directorates whose mission included counterterrorism, border security, immigration, cybersecurity, and disaster response and recovery. Earlier, as governor of Arizona, she focused on education from pre-kindergarten through public higher education and was the first woman to chair the National Governors Association. So she's had many firsts. She's an attorney attending the University of Virginia School of Law and has served the state of Arizona as an attorney general and U.S. attorney. Though she's a New York City native, Napolitano grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Albuquerque, New Mexico, where her father was dean of the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. She also spent a few years in the Bay Area studying political science at Santa Clara University, where she was Phi Beta Kappa, a Truman Scholar, and the university's first female valedictorian. It wasn't that long ago, right? As a graduate from the University of California, I'm personally so thrilled that we have her back in our lovely state. Please join me in welcoming the University of California's new president, Janet Napolitano.
Thank you, Anna, and thank you, members of the Commonwealth Club and all of the guests who are here this evening. What a nice welcome. What a wonderful venue. Many years ago, and I'm not saying exactly how many, this ballroom was where Santa Clara University, my alma mater, staged the senior ball. What a night we had on Nob Hill. I can remember it, or most of it, just like it was yesterday. We danced until closing, and then we wandered off to a nearby diner, Sears maybe, for breakfast, after which we stayed up to greet the dawn. Beyond that, no further comment. I may be a tenacious champion of transparency, but I'm also an ardent disciple of discretion. It's a great honor to be invited to come before the Commonwealth Club. It has such a rich tradition, providing a platform for a steady stream of national and world leaders. It was before the Commonwealth Club that Woodrow Wilson, laid out his vision for a League of Nations. FDR stood before this club as a presidential candidate and offered his prescription for a fair way out of the Great Depression. Martin Luther King Jr., Audrey Hepburn, Barry Goldwater, Bella Abzug's hat. It has been a wide-ranging and eclectic lineup that's come here to discuss the most pressing issues of the day. And I offer a toast to you. May that tradition continue for another 110 years. So what about tonight? Tonight you are getting one of California's newest citizens. And like so many Californians, I came here from someplace else. Most recently, Washington, D.C., but before that, Arizona, via New Mexico, via Pittsburgh, via New York City, where I was born. As I noted when I was appointed to serve as the 20th president of the University of California, I am a non-traditional choice. My background is in law and in public service, not in higher education. But that said, I do not enter this new realm as a total stranger. As was mentioned, my father had a PhD in anatomy and was dean of the medical school at the University of New Mexico. So one of my fondest childhood memories was hunting on the campus grounds for blue-tail lizards while Dad was in his lab checking on his experiments. Now, these lizards have detachable tails, and he would pay me and my siblings a nickel for every lizard's tail that we brought him. I don't think he really needed the lizards. He just needed a creative way to distract us so he could work in peace. My mother's degree was in zoology. My sister's degrees are in audiology. And my older brother is a PhD at Sandia Lab in Livermore. So put simply, I come from a family of scientists. As governor of Arizona, I kept my focus on education, including funding for all-day kindergarten and a new medical school, and fighting to ensure that our universities, even in tough budgetary times, had the resources they needed to pursue their own vision of excellence. Now, to be clear, my father's service as a medical school dean, my family's background in science, my own record as an undergraduate at Santa Clara and as a law student at the University of Virginia, none of that by itself qualifies me to lead the greatest public research university in the world. I think my selection was, in good measure, a result of my experience running large, complex institutions, such as the third largest department of the federal government and the state government of Arizona. I made clear from the start that my learning curve at UC would be a steep one, but I have faced steep learning curves before, and I have found that the upward trajectory can be accelerated by taking a couple of steps early on. The first is to dive into the budget. Budgets offer the most direct roadmap to what truly matters to an organization, and they show where opportunity for new priorities or fresh initiatives might be lurking in the budgetary weeds. Since arriving in California, my bedtime reading has been book after book of numbers. Numbers, numbers, more numbers. These days I dream in numbers. I don't count sheep to fall asleep. I count unrestricted funds and FTEs. I've also instigated a top-to-bottom efficiency review of the Office of the President. My understanding is that my predecessor did a terrific job of trimming and tightening, but there's always room for improvement. Our obligation as public servants is to stay constantly on the prowl for possible savings. The search for efficiencies is the administrative equivalent of painting the Golden Gate Bridge. The work never ends. The other essential immediate step in taking the helm of an institution like the UC system is to listen and to learn. This requires some discipline, because the natural instinct of any leader is to jump right in, hit the ground running with grand initiatives that signal intent. The problem is that ready, fire, aim is rarely a productive approach. The first thing you need to know is what you don't know. Then from that honest platform, you can begin to build your base of institutional knowledge. And so I have been out and about. Much of my first month as president has been spent visiting the constellation of UC campuses. Merced, San Diego, UCLA, the Berkeley Lab, Santa Cruz, Davis, Irvine. I've been everywhere, almost everywhere. Riverside, UCSF, Santa Barbara, and Berkeley will come soon. And of course, the end of this initial journey won't mean I've learned all there is to learn about UC. That would be both a silly and even a dangerous notion. I expect, and I truly hope, that I will be learning something new every single day I serve as president. But I've already learned enough to state, without equivocation, that UC is special. We're here to teach, to transmit knowledge, and to research, to create knowledge. And we do it better than anyone else. We teach for California, and we research for the world. So I'd like to share with you a few highlights encountered on my travels to date and also a few impressions. My very first night on a campus was at UC Merced, and I do mean night. I sat in on a biology class. Merced doesn't have a lot of classroom space. Classes start early, they run late, and they run 6 days a week. This one started at 9:15 p.m. I saw two dozen students squinting into their microscopes hours after the sun went down. That tells me two things. First, these students are hell-bent on getting their educations. And second, we need to build more classrooms. Because when I think about those students, all I hear is Ray Liotta whispering, "If you build it, they will come." At UC San Diego, I met the brain whisperers. These are the scientists answering President Obama's call to map the activity of the human brain. They're creating the technology we need to map the brain down to single cells within the time scale of a millisecond. They're doing it across academic disciplines, from neuroscience to chemistry to nanoscience. And they showed me that collaboration is a big part of the spirit of a public research university. I spent one night in a living laboratory at UC Davis. It's called West Village, and it's the largest planned zero-net energy community in the country. On the ground floor, they're researching batteries and conservation and water. On the next floor up, faculty, students, and staff live and work side by side in structures that make use of the green technologies being explored on the floor below. It's a mini ecosystem with a lot of solar panels, and it's going to show the world that zero net energy is practical, and practical on a large scale. At UC Santa Cruz, I toured the campus's marine lab. It's one of the jewels of the university. I was invited to pet a shark. I just got here from Washington. I've had my fill of sharks. So I petted a dolphin instead. The Long Marine Lab has become a major hub of marine research worldwide. And the professor who runs the lab, Gary Griggs, has taught and researched at Santa Cruz for more than 40 years. One of his students was Catherine Sullivan, who became an astronaut and was the first woman to walk in space. Professors like Gary don't just do research. They also teach. He told me, and he will tell anyone, that there is no toggle switch delineating research from teaching. It's not an either-or proposition. The blend of teaching and research is its own phenomenon. It's the magic mix that leads both to creating new knowledge and to educating students, not just instructing them. Now, UCLA let me drop in on a women's basketball practice. Standing beside me was Rafer Johnson, the Olympic gold medalist and a UCLA alum. He's one of California's and the country's greatest track athletes. Rafer had a story to tell about why he chose to attend UCLA in the 1950s. As you might imagine, he had many options, but he wanted to be a student body president. So he made a point of visiting the student resource centers on every campus trying to recruit him. UCLA, he said, was the only one with a photo of an African-American student on the wall. The rest is Bruin history. I think Rafer's story tells us something about how diversity really works, because the history of UC shows how great public research universities can be vehicles for social advancement. Thousands upon thousands of UC alumni were first-generation immigrants and the first in their families to attend college. Today, 45% of our freshmen are first-generation college students. One out of every three are from historically underrepresented minority groups. And more than 40% of all UC students are low income. Four of our campuses each have more low-income students than all eight Ivy League universities combined. So there's a subset here, however, that deserves special mention. The subset of undocumented students. These dreamers, as they are often called, are students who would have benefited from a federal DREAM Act. They are students who deserve the opportunity to succeed and to thrive at UC. I know this issue very well. I testified in Congress in support of the DREAM Act and in support of comprehensive immigration reform. When the DREAM Act failed to get cloture in the Senate, I instituted a plan called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or as it's known by its acronym, DACA. And to date, almost 600,000 students nationally have qualified for DACA. So let me be clear. UC welcomes all students who qualify academically, whether they're documented or undocumented. And to help meet the special needs of dreamers, I'd like to make an announcement here with you tonight. I'm going to set aside $5 million right now for this year to support these students with resources like trained advisors, student service centers, and financial aid. Consider this a down payment, one more piece of evidence of our commitment to all Californians. UC will continue to be a vehicle for social mobility. We teach for California. We research for the world. Now, I'm often asked why I decided to come to UC at this time, and it's a fair question. The answer rests in how California, across its history, has so often managed to lead the world to new ways of thinking, to new ways of conducting itself as a society. As California goes, so often goes the world. This was clear to me in Arizona. It was clear to me in Washington. What I came to realize, however, it's that it's also true that as the University of California goes, so goes California. The two grew up together, forming a symbiotic relationship that literally altered their shared future. Put another way, California would not be the society it is today without the University of California. And the opposite is also true. And so, in my view, I have taken on a high-stakes proposition. Not to go all Tom Friedman on you, but the world around us is changing profoundly and undeniably. Irresistible forces of transformation are converging on many fronts at once: technical, environmental, economic, political, demographic, you name it. The changes are global in their sweep, but a real and present fact of everyday life in every locale. That includes, of course, California. We live in a crossroads moment, and where we end up is not predestined. Will we find new ways to work and live together, to build a prosperous, hopeful society that embraces diversity, not runs from it, to harness technology for the benefit of all, not just the fortunes of a few, to protect the environment even as our growing population places ever greater pressure on its resources? We can shape the answers to these and other fundamental questions. We can shape the future, and once more, California can show the world the way. And the one big reason why it can, I'm here to tell you, is the University of California and its time-tested power to provide a fulcrum on which the state can pivot toward a brighter day. At the state's first constitutional convention, pioneers still brushing dust from the gold fields off their trousers were expressing the hope that they may create a university of their own. And in time, with help from President Lincoln's Moral Land Grant Act, they built the University of California. And they built it to their own specifications, California specifications. And to quote Daniel Coit Gilman, one of the earliest and most influential UC presidents, it's not the University of Berlin nor of New Haven, which we are to copy, but it is the university of this state. It must be adapted to this people, to their public and private schools, to their peculiar geographical position, to the requirements of their new society. Amen to all of that. In the early 20th century, it would be UC research that would lead California's transition from a simple farming practice to the monolithic known as modern agriculture. Californians, once confined to growing only what the rains would allow, learned to produce more crops with greater yields than the world had ever seen come out of one place. And we're doing it still. As food insecurity looms as perhaps the single most daunting global issue of our time, California's export, not just of crops, but also of the science and expertise needed to grow them, will become ever more vital. But California won't deliver for the world without UC. Another example. 60 years ago, as the baby boomers were coming of age, UC President Clark Kerr and Governor Pat Brown led the way to the creation of California's Master Plan for Higher Education. As part of this, the university soon opened 3 new campuses. It enrolled thousands more Californians of all backgrounds. It laid the groundwork for a well-educated and active citizenry that has benefited the state ever since. And it led to a revitalized version of the California dream. I could grow on. The growth of the aerospace industry, the intellectual seeding of Silicon Valley, these and many other phenomena can be traced back to particular moments when the university and the state worked together for the benefit of all Californians and ultimately for the benefit of people around the world. So again, UC teaches for California, it researches for the world. The significance of this dynamic equation will only grow. That's why I came here to serve. My intent is to be the best advocate possible for what this university and this state can achieve together. UC, like California, simply cannot afford to stand still. If you're standing still in California, you are falling behind. This is a dynamic institution and a dynamic state living together in a dynamic time. This means that at UC, excellence in research and education must be more than just maintain, must be more than a catchy phrase, must be real, and it must be accelerated. That's why, in 2 weeks, I'm going to be coming to the UC Regents with some big ideas for their consideration. In the meantime, however, I've heard enough to know that if we are to remain a premier research university, we must increase our support for postdoctoral fellows and graduate students. Our postdocs are key researchers in our labs and teachers in our classrooms. So tonight, I'm announcing a $5 million increase in the President's Fellowship Program for postdoctoral fellows. And to help fill the postdoc pipeline, I'm announcing tonight an additional $5 million to recruit the world's best graduate students to our campuses. Graduate students and postdocs are the essential links between teaching for California and researching for the world. They are our future faculty members. They are our future innovators. They are our future Nobel laureates. They merit our additional support right now. Some of my ideas are larger in their reach and will take more time in the greenhouse. You'll hear more about them at the Regents' meeting in November and in the months after that. Moving the university forward in innovative new ways is critical, and not just because of the technological, environmental, and economic forces at play today. It's also because there's a tremendous demographic shift unfolding around us. In California, there is a new generation knocking at the door. This generation might look and speak a bit differently than the students of Clark Kerr's time. After all, a majority of California's K-12 students today hail from diverse, historically underrepresented groups, but they still qualify for UC at a ratio far below that of their peers. This must change. This is a moral imperative. The California dream and all that that phrase invokes must not be allowed to die off with the baby boomers. And again, the University of California represents the state's best shot at making this happen. Make no mistake, these students share the same dreams as those who came before them. This morning, I visited Oakland Technical High School. It's not far from UC's central office. It's my new home away from home. I met with students in Oakland Tech's leadership classes and with students in the school's African American Male Initiative program. Then I spoke at a rally for 500 students. They came from a range of backgrounds with distinct family demographics and distinct interests. But when I looked out onto the auditorium, all I could see was one vast sea of hope and yearning, their faces lit up, absolutely lit up, by the idea of making their way to the University of California. When I say UC teaches for California, I'm talking about serving the hope and aspiration that was so palpable in that auditorium. I'm talking about transformation, one student at a time. And let's be clear, all Californians have a stake in this. Affordability, accessibility, diversity, these give California the citizens and workforce it needs to be a global leader, always pushing forward and upward. And so academic excellence at the university must remain paramount. It is crucial as we teach for California. It's also crucial as we research for the world. And I know the connection between teaching and research and its impact beyond campus borders can sometimes be difficult to grasp. So let me put it this way. When thinking about academic excellence, the question to ask is who benefits? Who benefits? The answer is everyone, everywhere. Consider Randy Shechtman. He's a UC Berkeley professor, just awarded the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine. Randy was educated at UCLA and Stanford. We don't hold the latter against him. He has taught at Berkeley for more than 3 decades. Freshman seminars, postdoc supervision, you name it. Years ago, he started researching yeast and the transport and secretion of proteins in cells. Like all those engaged in basic research, exactly where the quest would lead could not be known as he set out. Potential applications are rarely clear at the outset. But where it led, eventually, was to discoveries that have since changed how the world treats hepatitis B and diabetes, and soon perhaps even Alzheimer's. Teach for California and research for the world. This is the reason UC must thrive as a public enterprise. California and the university that proudly shares its name can show the world to a society that is more prosperous, more enlightened, different in many ways than what was in the past, but not in its essence. A society where hope and opportunity are not just words, they're realities. So, yeah, I thought it'd be pretty cool to take all this on. Pretty cool indeed. Stay tuned. Thank you.
Thank you, President Napolitano. And I like saying President Napolitano. We might do that for a number of years in a number of formats. I'm going to start with a few questions to follow up on your talk and then take some specific questions from the audience. And there's a lot. And you can continue to write them on cards and send them in, and we'll cover as much as we can. And I wanted to start out by talking a little bit about your statement about starting with the budget. And I promise not to talk about unrestricted funds and restricted funds. But I do want to know, I first thought I would ask you what your favorite number is, but I think it might be 5 million. I think that may be your favorite number. So talk to me a little bit more about the 5 million that you set aside for those first-generation underrepresented students and how you see those students transforming both the state of California and the UC system.
Well, this is 5 million for the so-called dreamers. Dreamers are kids who were brought here as children by their parents or their families and have basically grown up in California and followed all the rules, studied hard, did well enough to be admitted to the University of California, which is very tough. The academic standards are very high. Yet they are undocumented. Many of them qualify for DACA, but that doesn't cover anything. And because these students are undocumented, they can't qualify for federal grant support. They can't qualify for work authorization, like work study. And it's really a difficult position to be an undocumented student and put all of your energies where they should be, which is on your academic work. So, they do merit special attention. And what I want to make sure we do is have people on each of our 10 campuses in resource centers where they can go. They can get the information about how to adjust their immigration status, if that's possible, about things they... scholarships or grants that they might qualify for. Oftentimes, they're first generation, very poor families, first generation, and receive support in that way because there may be no one at home that can really talk with them about their student life and how to handle exam time and what does it mean to go to grad school and how do you apply and how do you get in that system. So I think we need to recognize these students are here and they are California and they're going to be in California, and we want to make sure we cover that appropriately.
And it builds very much on the history of the UC system and creating opportunity.
The UC system, as I mentioned, it is a tremendous engine for California. And even if you don't have a student, child attending there or what have you, I'll tell you this. My perception is that you cannot turn around in California without running into some aspect of the research we've done or the teaching we've done. It's everywhere in the state.
And if I could talk just a bit about the other part, that's the Teach for California and the Research for the World. There's a lot of new models coming out for partnering internationally for higher education. Duke and NYU actually have campuses in China now. There's a lot of more exchange going on. I'm wondering if you see some of the, I need to quit saying you see, except in a specific way, I'm just realizing.
Yeah.
If you envision the UC system evolving its international partnerships in a particular way, in addition to talking maybe a bit more about the initiatives that you just announced tonight for postgraduates and postdocs.
Right. It's too early for me to make a recommendation about international campuses to which you refer. As secretary, I visited a lot of countries around the world, 40 to be precise, and many of them many times. And I saw some of those campuses being built. Whether that's something we want to do remains for a later day. I can say, however, that this is a world in which our students are going to graduate into a very globalized economy and a world that's ever more closely interconnected. And a lot of that's been facilitated by the huge technological advances that have happened over the past few decades. So an understanding and appreciation of what that means not just living in the world, but of the world, so to speak, that's something that should be benchmarked as part of a good education.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I also wanted to talk just briefly about a question that a number of folks have already asked about your role as a pioneer for women in a number of roles, including this one. And I heard Malcolm Gladwell talk recently, and he tried to differentiate between pioneers and tokens. He said pioneers make the way for people behind them, that they're setting the standard, and that tokens are often one and done. There's a number of questions in the pile about what it means to you to be the first woman in various roles and how you make the way for other women to move into leadership positions.
Yeah, I didn't know the difference between being a pioneer versus not, but I'll tell you an anecdote. In 1998, I was elected to be the Attorney General of Arizona. And that year, all five statewide constitutional offices, from governor down to superintendent of public instruction, were elected women. First time in American history. Yeah, ran the whole slate. So they started calling us, we didn't run as a ticket or anything. It just happened that way. We're not even all of the same political party, just the same gender. Anyway, they started calling us the Fab Five. And Business Week or Time, one of the weekly news magazines, had a feature on the 98 election. And it was headlined, Odd Things About the 1998 Election. And it had a page divided diagonally in half, and it was the Fab Five and Jesse Ventura. That was it. We were it. I have been trying to pave the way for others, not just in being a candidate for political office, but being leaders in public service. And I think one important part of that is mentoring younger women. Because if you talk to women who are so-called first, so many times it's a mentor that has really helped them as they've grown into a profession, into a career that's really enabled them to advance. In my case, it was the senior partner at the law firm I joined and also the judge for whom I clerked right out of law school. And they were mentors. The judge is still, I consider her still a mentor for me. So paving the way by being an active mentor, I think, it's enjoyable. It's a lot of fun. But I also think it's a responsibility we share.
So you did start out saying that you're you know, getting very familiar with the budget, and so I'm going to take that as an opportunity to ask what seems to be the most popular question here in one form or another, which is what you hope to do or plan to do to make UC education affordable. Lots of concerns about the cost of tuition, the rise in tuition rates, and financial access to UC education.
Right. And there's no question that the increase in tuition here has been very, there's been a large increase in tuition and fees over a relatively short period of time, so it's been very noticeable by students and their families. I've asked my team to look at two things. One is the amount of tuition just the absolute number. And the other is volatility in tuition to see if there are some ways that we can limit any tuition increases, but also inject some predictability into the whole tuition setting process so that when you apply to UC and are admitted, you and your family kind of know what your nut is, you know, what it is that you need to have. The other thing, and I think this bears mentioning, tuition has increased, but the financial aid that is available to UC students, I think we need to talk about that more. We need to market ourselves more. So I was at Oakland Tech this morning, virtually all the students are from low-income families there. When I asked them, they said, well, they're all afraid of the amount of tuition at the UC, even though they want to go there. So I said, well, how many of you come from families where your parents make or $80,000 a year or less? They all raised their hands. I said, you don't pay tuition at the University of California if your family makes $80,000 a year or less. It is free. You don't pay a single dollar. It's called the Blue and Gold Program. But I got to tell you, we need to talk about that more because we are going to do our darndest to make sure that if a student qualifies academically, they've done that work, they've hit the books, they've done what we ask, that finances do not stand in the way of their being able to get a world-class education at the UC. So, just so you know.
Great.
You can all talk about that with your friends. Yeah.
And this is a Commonwealth Club, so the questions are smart, and they're going to ask me to dig a little bit deeper on this particular piece. A couple of people actually asked about how you can encourage students to major or finance education in fields that will not necessarily lead to an immediate payoff. How do we encourage students or finance students to be teachers, to be in public service jobs, when they know that's not going to lead to a high paycheck the second they step out of the door?
Well, in other words, how do you encourage students to go into public service type work as opposed to something that may be more lucrative?
Yes.
Some would say you get paid in psychic dollars because the jobs are really interesting and rewarding. And if, you know, you really want to get in there and affect change on a larger scale or even on a child-by-child scale, public service is right up your alley. And the work is fascinating. I'm an attorney by training, when I would go back to my law school reunions, I would be with my peers. So many of them were richer than I am in actual dollars by a lot, and they were bored out of their minds, and they were beginning to wonder, they were in their 40s and 50s, you know, what am I doing? What am I doing here? Is this really what I got educated to do? And then they'd come over and ask me how I did what I did, and that sounded so interesting to them. So I think we need to talk more about how public service and government service is just a fascinating way to invest oneself in meaningful work.
So a couple more questions, then we'll move past the finance and tuition questions. But you did say this was your first part of the learning curve, and you studied it.
Yeah,
so.
I walked right into it.
Sorry about that. So here's a couple of other questions about how much the state does and doesn't support things. Several folks want to know, should the university just be released from the state so that we can raise more revenue? And there's another comment that's similar to one I've heard a colleague quote back to me, that we went from being state-supported to state-assisted to, you know, kind of state-harassed in terms of the regulations but not the support. So the question is, what is the appropriate relationship from state support versus tuition dollars? And are there things that we can ask from the state in terms of greater freedom in order to help balance out the lessening state support?
Well, I think, and I can say this as a former governor myself, that state support for public universities pretty much went down everywhere because of the recession. And when you're a governor, you know, your budget has to, you know, you've got three big items. You gotta cover K-12, you gotta cover Medicaid, and you have to cover the cost of incarceration. So those are big mandatory parts of the budget. The next biggest part of state budget typically is the higher education system. And because, you know, funding there is somewhat discretionary, we saw large cuts being made in California, in other states across the board. I think it's now time, with the economy coming back and with the voters signaling their intent with the passage of Prop 30, to renew the compact between the university and the state and really revitalize the position that, and the point, one of the points I was trying to make tonight, which is to say that the university is something that benefits all Californians. It's a public university. And that benefit comes not just directly in the form of a student getting a world-class education. It comes indirectly in the form of things that the university does, economic growth and jobs that it provides. I could go on with that. So I think there is room to have that discussion. And I think we will be having that discussion as we move forward. But the idea of privatizing the university, taking it off the books, so to speak, I think I am far from persuaded that that would be any benefit. And again, I think there's something very special about saying you are a public education and research university for all Californians.
You've had a lot of some time to spend visiting the system and the campus. I don't know how much of a chance you've had to be in the larger community. There's several questions about town-gown relations and how you see the various campuses relating to their local communities and what kind of a role you think they play locally as well as across the state.
I've seen a little. Usually when I go to visit a campus, we try to arrange a meeting with community stakeholders and so forth. And obviously, an initial visit can only teach you so much. But it is very important that the campuses themselves are good citizens of the communities in which they exist. And so that relationship, which must be keyed from the chancellor and the leadership team of the chancellor, is very important. When I was in Merced, I use Merced as an example, it's already the key economic driver for that part of the state and a big part of the community. And people feel that connection. Other parts of the state, the same way at different scales. So, I think some of the town gown, there, obviously there will be differences from time to time. There are, but you work them through, you work with, and you think mutually what can be done together to leverage what the university brings to what the community can bring as well.
And I just need to remind us that this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and we are talking to the University of California's new president, Janet Napolitano. I'm Dr. Mary Marcy, the moderator this evening, and you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and see video of the programs online at Fora TV. Now, one of the things that's gotten a lot of attention within higher education, and has certainly got our audience's attention based on the number of questions, is the advent of MOOCs, or massive open online courses, and kind of suggestion that this is a new or reinvention of online learning that can really shake up higher education. In your conversations and travels so far, have you had a chance to talk to people about MOOCs? Do you think it's going to fundamentally change higher education? Do you have some thoughts about how it might affect UC?
MOOCs. I mean, what an acronym. Like, really? I know enough to know that there's no silver bullet here. I mean, a MOOC, to the extent people think there's a problem, MOOCs are not a silver bullet answer. From what I have observed to date, I think an appropriate role for online education needs to be thought through for UC. I mean, I think we're in the 21st century. Not to think about online education is a little bit like putting your head in the sand. It will never replace the in-person academic experience. But can it effectively, in some kinds of courses and some areas, be used to good measure and help with and maintain the academic excellence that our students deserve? Yeah, I think we need to look at what that kind of an appropriate role is. So we have lots of experiments going on lots of different campuses. And I think some may prove pretty interesting and pretty successful, and some will fail. Because that's the process of experimentation. And I'll be eagerly watching some of those experiments and see what makes sense for the UC.
We have several folks that want to hear more about the green projects that you saw and the research that's being done for renewable energy and sustainable models within the UC systems. Can you talk a little bit more about what you observed? I think it was up at Davis, and what else is going on that you know of in the UC system for that type of research?
There's a ton of work being done on sustainable energy, and a lot of our campuses are already over 80-85% off the grid for their energy demands, and that's a big deal. Energies are large consumers. I mean, universities are large consumers of energy, particularly the universities with health centers, because medical schools, hospitals, just think about what goes on in those places. They use a lot of energy. For example, at Davis, the utilization, development of energy out of biogas and how that is used to fuel or provide energy for the community, that's one aspect. The fuel demands for automobiles and different types of engines and things for automobiles, that's another thing. So just and then of course solar. The sun shines a lot in Davis and there's a lot of room for solar. So that's the kind of thing and the kind of creativity that we're asking of our UC campuses.
Several questions about UC's relationship to the K-12 system and whether there's things that can be done from the UC level to help improve the quality of California public education at the K-12 level. If you have thoughts about how to create greater support or outreach with that system.
I think I'm going to hold on answering that question. That invokes a very fundamental and complex set of issues
And I don't think a quick on-the-fly answer is a good idea. Obviously, the goal of any of any education system is to provide opportunity and access to learning, to research, and the like. Different school districts, I'm sure, in the state are positioned differently in that regard. So I will ask for leave from the committee to respond later.
And I think that's a sign that you're a very quick learner. It's a complex question.
Yeah.
So a couple of other questions that are not directly related to the UC system, but are very interested in your leadership style and your personal way of leading. And the top, I think, is a plant in the audience. It says, from your time at Santa Clara, how did that type of education, that Jesuit education, influence you through your career and now through your time at UC? So Santa Clara alum out there, we got it.
Well, thank you, Father Prevett. I saw you. I think, you know, I was a political science major in college, but I took, I was in the college honors program, which had numerous course requirements in the humanities, composition, literature, foreign language, philosophy, theology, mathematics, laboratory science. And so through that experience, I had a great exposure to a general liberal arts education. And I really think that's when I began to think. I mean, I was a public school product in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and not being critical, just descriptive, I didn't know a whole lot when I came out of high school. And that point was driven home when I got my first English paper back at Santa Clara. So I really had to learn to up my game and what studying really means and what it entails. And then to have a broad exposure in a number of different areas has just helped me now when I wrestle with questions of policy, questions where there's no right or wrong answer. And to appreciate that the more complex questions of our day don't permit of a right or wrong answer. And there are nuances. And nuance is a very important thing in public policy. So, and I think that appreciation really began to develop at Santa Clara.
Makes sense. There's another set of questions, which is also a bit more about your kind of personal path and personal background that ask questions about being a woman in different roles and wondering, has that changed as you've moved into higher leadership positions and as society has evolved a little bit? Is it different to be a woman in this type of position in 2013 than it was to be governor of Arizona 10 years ago or so, and was it different when you were first attorney general? Has society changed? Has your comfort with it changed?
I'm reminded when I announced that I was running for attorney general of Arizona. Now, I'd been the U.S. attorney for Arizona for over 4 years and had worked on some big matters like the Oklahoma City bombing investigation and prosecution because McVeigh did most of his planning in Arizona. And so when I resigned and announced that I was going to run for the AG slot, a reporter called me a couple days later and he goes, "Hey, Janet, that was a great announcement, but I have a question." He says, "Do you plan to run as a woman?" Think about that question for just a minute. And I was like, yeah, I guess. But what he really meant was I got a campaign on issues that were specific to women. And when you think about it, anybody who is campaigning, who is leading, your decisions and your decision-making process are influenced by your life experience, and you're going to see things through that. And so you might set priorities a bit differently. I think our society in the United States has become more and more accustomed to women and what have historically been only male roles. I think, make no mistake, there are difficulties, there are challenges. I could go into some of those and what I think the current state of affairs is, but I think overall it's better than it was, and it's not all that it should be.
Have a number of people who are wondering about your relationship within the what used to be called, and I guess to some degree still is, the California Master Plan, and how you see UC relating to Cal State and to the community college system and the other kind of broad public institutions in the state. Have you had a chance to connect with any of those institutions to date?
Yeah, not. I've spoken on the phone with the leadership, and I'm sure we'll be getting together. I think the master plan was really one of the great reforms of the last century, and made California a unique place, and made it. And really gave it kind of a lot of the drive and the so-called, I talked about the California dream, was really an embodiment of the California dream in as expressed in higher education. So, we begin with the master plan, but we also need to recognize that, you know, it's dynamic and we're changing all the time. So, these are things that require us, the leadership of the UC and the CSU system and the community college system, to really explore ways about how the master plan should be expressed in today's environment and how it should be put into place.
Good. And I think we're running a little bit low on time, so I don't think I'm allowed to let you out, based on the questions in this pile, I don't think I'm allowed to let you out without a question about Cal football. Now, they seem to go in a couple of directions. There's a few folks that are concerned about the performance of the team. There are other folks worried about the intersection of big-time athletics and higher education. You can go anywhere you want with that. I'm not going to take responsibility. That's all I know.
I can go anywhere. Well, UCLA's playing pretty well. Listen, I think when students play sports and they play on our teams, they are students. And they are here to get an education as well as to perform athletically. And to the extent we are not meeting the embodiment of what should be a student athlete, that's a problem. And it needs to be addressed and addressed very vigorously and aggressively. It will require the leadership of the chancellor, and everyone involved, but I can see no reason at all. It is simply unacceptable for the great University of California at Berkeley to receive the ranking that it did. We have to do better.
Well, I have the privilege of thanking our guest, President Napolitano, and I want to say that she started out by saying that she was an unconventional candidate to lead the University of California, but she also said that her background is in law and public service. And I can think of the public service part has come through loud and clear this evening, and we really could not have someone more committed to that aspect of leadership of the most important public university in the country and indeed in the world. So thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I think I can do this. I do want to say that today's program has been part of the club's series on ethics and accountability, underwritten by the generosity of the Charles Travers family. Thanks to Janet Napolitano and our audience here on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Dr. Mary Marcy, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.